Hello, farmers. This is Hugo Dizzle on the phone, bringing you another Talk the Walk. We've got the absolute pleasure of having online Gary McDool, who we met at Meeting the Challenge of Change, which Dr. Christine Jones put together, and Gary was a keynote speaker. So, Gary, without too much talk, are you on the line there, Gary?
Yes, I am. Thanks. Here you go.
Gary, can you give us a bit of a rundown of your involvement, maybe with RCS, or what? Just give us a bit of a rundown of who you are and, you know, what you do.
Yes, certainly. Well, first and foremost, I'm a farmer, a cattle producer from the northwest slopes and plains of northern New South Wales. And I'm now probably only half a farmer in that we sold half our country about 4 years ago. It was part of a succession planning exercise, which I'm very proud of. It actually turned out to be quite timely, and it's freed us up to do all sorts of other things. So a farmer, but also I do some work for RCS, Resource Consulting Services, as I think my title is Senior Consultant and Teacher. So I teach their range of courses and do quite a bit of one-on-one consulting. And in addition to that, very involved in the local community, and in particular a project called The Living Classroom, which we'll talk about, and also involved in energy work as a Dawson Program practitioner.
Golly gosh, that is a lot. I hope we can get through a fair. I hope we can get a bit of an understanding on those particular subjects. I just do know that we'll talk about energy probably a little bit later. But one disturbing thing that I heard or read was Professor John Crawford at Sydney University said that the way farmers are farming at the moment, with the soil being depleted, they've got 20 years to farm. Do you think that's an overstatement, Gary?
Look, I think there's a lot of truth in that statement, because the one thing that we have essentially ignored as farmers is the thing that's the very foundation of what we do, which is soil, the health of our soils. And demonstrably, we've been mining that soil for a very long time. There are farmers, of course, who are not doing that and who are doing things very differently. So that's alarming, because that pretty much assumes the status quo. And as I said at the conference at Vega, the status quo will not continue. We're facing a very different future. And the fact that we are means that we will have to do things differently, not just because we've been mining our resource base.
Right. And you say there's a few farmers who, or a number of farmers who are not in that boat. How would you describe them? Why are they not in that boat? And whether they cover grazing, do they cover cropping as well?
Well, it's interesting, because they're across the spectrum, and they form a very loose but connected, experientially connected group, I suppose. Some of those people are in the network that Major General Michael Jeffries has referred to, and as I think he identified 17 farmers that he believes are his champion farmers. For every one of those 17, there's probably at least another 5 or 6 people or families that are doing things very, very differently than they've been done in the past. And it's actually quite a strong movement, but it's just a bit disconnected and hasn't really had a focus. And if you extrapolate out worldwide what's happening in Australia, then it's a very, very strong movement. And I think you'll find that these sort of disconnected people become very connected over the next 5 to 10 years and become recognised as a very, very strong movement.
Can you describe those sort of farmers? And maybe your farming would be in that particular role. Can you give a bit of a rundown of what one of the two of those farmers might look like?
Well, I think the first thing is that they are very open to change. And that's not a statement that you can make, unfortunately, I think, about the significant majority of farmers in Australia. And if we want to adapt, and if we want to be proactive in the face of a rapidly changing environment, then not only do we have to be open to it, but we need to be looking to the opportunities in it. And I think that's what these farmers are doing. And so they're exploring all sorts of things and recognising that if we want to be viable in a rapidly changing environment, then we can't do things that were more applicable, you know, 5, 10 or 20 years ago.
Can you describe one particular farm or a couple of farmers that what are they doing differently or what they look like from maybe peering over the fence? Or?
Well, I'll just talk about our situation because I'd like to think that we're in that category. So we recognise that that things are going to be very different in the future. We recognise that the faster the rate of change, the more opportunities there will be. We recognise that we're not necessarily just farmers, but that we can create a variety of income streams and areas of interest, and that they can complement each other. So in our case, we were one of the very early adopters of a different method of grazing management. We focused on native grasses at a time when native grasses were essentially an ignored resource, and I think probably still are to a large extent. We also generated all sorts of areas of interest and income streams outside the farm. And it is interesting that in Australia, we believe that if you're a farmer, you need to be a farmer and that's it. Whereas in most parts of the world, farmers actually do generate income from a variety of sources.
Right. So, apart from grazing, what is another area, not necessarily yours, but what is another area that a farmer could be moving into?
Well, I think there are a number of people engaged in farmers. We'd all be familiar with people like Carl Seitz, who's essentially designed a way of farming, broadacre farming, that both builds the ecological balance sheet as well as the financial balance sheet. And it's probably fair to say that the more broadacre the area, the less enthusiastic people have been to look at doing things differently. So the focus has really been, if you go west of where we live, which is broadacre, traditionally the heart of cropping country to the west and to the southwest of us, there's been an enormous amount of effort in terms of improving efficiency and productivity based on doing things essentially the same way that they've been done for a long period of time. And that still is very much the focus at the scientific and agronomic level, that the answers lie in improving productivity with essentially maintaining the same sort of system. And that's an approach, and there's a lot of validity in that approach, but I think we're going to need more than that. The farming systems that we have and look at doing things differently.
Think that's what John Crawford is talking about, that you just can't keep doing something and be more efficient.
There's a lot of good stuff going on in the more efficiency area. And it's an important part of what we need to be doing in the future. But we also need to be challenging the basics of the way in which we go about things.
Because one thing you did mention in meeting the challenge of change, for change, I should say, was that production, we're focusing on production, not profitability. Would you like to explain that a bit more clearly?
Well, simply they're not the same thing. And yet we've been very, very focused on production. And we've been very successful at improving production. But if you look at the profitability of our farming community, and I think you can now say right across all of the industries that we're involved in, it's looking pretty sick, despite these very substantial improvements in production. For a whole variety of reasons, but the fact is that, just take the grazing industry, for example, you can have a very high input model and very high levels of production and be losing money.
Yeah. Now, you did also mention about energies. Now, many years ago, we had Dr. Ard Nansen come here and we talked about paramagnetic energies, and he trained quite a few people there, and he showed people how to douse and that sort of thing. What sort of energies were you talking about? What sort of energies have you got in mind? And we also got that.
Yeah, look, I'm glad you mentioned that, and Anderson, because I picked up one of his very early books, and what he talked about was, what sits in behind things like radionics and so on? What's it all about? And it was very good, and I've never actually seen it explained by anybody quite that way, including Arden Anderson, since then. But the sort of energy that we work with is, a broad term for it is subtle energy, or geomancy is another word, and that applies really to the land-related energy patterns. But we, for about the last 8 years, have been working with energy health and healing in people and animals, and to some extent on the land and in physical spaces. And more recently, in the last 4 or 5 years, we've been quite involved in geomancy. Dr. Patrick McManaway is a international specialist in this area, and he's been brought to Australia by RCS, and he's now coming out 3 times a year and working with a whole range of farmers in terms of understanding the effect of energy fields on farms and the production thereof. It's a very big subject, and that was a very brief summary.
I know, but I think that summary was just going to leave people more confused than...
Let's explore it a little further then.
If you don't mind.
Yeah. Well, let's just talk about energy to start with. What is energy? And every living thing is made up of energy. And that's essentially what we are. We're not substantial matter. We're made up of a whole pile of energy. And energy works in fields and in waves, and we'd all be familiar with that basic concept. And what happens is that those energy fields and waves can be thrown out of kilter in people, most often than not by emotional things. And that emotion can throw the energy fields out. And what then happens, and the work that we've been involved in is probably a little unique in this respect, is that that translates to physical changes in people. And those physical changes can be very easily demonstrated, both pre and post working with people. And so what happens when you correct the energy field, you actually correct the physical body as well. And that translates not just into things that are a direct effect, for flow-on effect from being out of kilter physically, but also things like the way in which you think and behave and so on, because you're actually changing the structure of the bones in the skull. It's quite fascinating. It is highly repeatable, and it brings about the most enormous changes in people and animals, and to some extent in areas of land as well.
That's what I read on Patrick McManaway's little flyer that came out. I think it was came from RCS.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so what do you do, lessons, or can you sort of, how does it sort of work for people? How do people get involved, and what's the advantages for people to get involved?
Well, if we just take the work on people to start with, we work with a program called the Dawson Program, which is just one modality of many, many modalities that exist in relation to subtle energy. And everybody would be familiar with, like Reiki or acupuncture or whatever. One of the extraordinary things is that wherever you go in the world, outside areas that are dominated by Western medicine, you find that working with energy is absolutely fundamental to the human health practices of that civilization. And we've just come back from Peru, and we spent about a week focused in this area in the Sacred Valley, which is a very high energy part of Peru. And the practices that are engaged in there are exactly the same. There might be some slight difference in terminology, but they're exactly the same as the practices that might be engaged in, take India, for example, so, and Tibet, where we use a lot of Tibetan influence in the work that we do. So there are three or two entirely disconnected societies. They never would have had any interaction between them, and yet they all use essentially the same stuff. Western medicine thinks that it's a nonsense, and Western medicine represents 1 billion out of 7 billion people in the world, and the other six will work with energy. So.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the Western side of things has been totally commercialized or run by vested interests, whereas the Indian thing, I can't talk about Peru, but the Indian thing has been run by sort of a belief system that's had some sort of natural basis. That's how I see it. Whereas where industry will just have basically peddled something that suits them. And,
well, that's one of the challenges with energy work is that there's nothing to peddle. I mean, there are no commodities sitting in behind energy medicine. That's really just a question of understanding or gaining some understanding, and we only have a very small insight into what's a very big field, but some understanding about how it all works.
Yeah, well, today I went to a local masseur naturopath, and she does Reiki and she does massages on horses. That's her specialty. She's also trained in the equine industry.
Yep.
So I presume you are, when we're talking about energies, can you explain some of the energies?
Sorry, can I explain?
Can you explain some of the energies, like where that could help a farmer, apart from the farmer himself? How would it help a farmer to come along to one of the courses?
Well, so the first thing is that if you're not balanced yourself energetically, then a couple of things will happen. The first is that the basic premises of a lot of this work is that the body is a self-healing mechanism if you give it a chance to do so. If you're energetically out of whack, then it's going to be starting behind the eight ball. And so the first thing is, if you want to open a farmer's mind, is to make sure that he or she is balanced energetically. And that's really important. And for me, if I can just work from my personal experience, I've done lots of challenging and interesting things over the last 8 years since I first got introduced to this energy work. If I was like I was 8 years ago, there is no way in the world I could have done what I've done. Because I just wouldn't have had the mindset to do it. And so the actual people side of things is probably the most important thing. And I think that applies to what happens on the farm. So the attitude, an attitude, you heard the saying, attitude is everything. The attitude of the farming family is very fundamental to the success or otherwise that they'll make on their farm. So that's really important. But in the same way that you can work with people, you can work with animals. And we've got lots of animal stories. But you can actually transform the way in which animals behave. You can transform, have a significant impact on animal performance. And so on. So that's really just working with energy on people and animals. But then there's another whole area which is more the geomancy, which is that the earth is ringed by all sorts of energy fields, some of which have a positive influence and some of which don't. And some sort of understanding of that can substantially improve productivity. And Patrick McManaway is now working with farmers right throughout Australia and producing some really interesting evidence of the sort of changes that's taking place on farm. So it's a very big subject and probably only one of the subjects we want to talk about tonight, but absolutely fascinating, and I encourage everybody to put their toe in the water and try and learn a little bit about it. Terry McCosker has been quoted, and Terry's the principal of RCS and has been working with progressive Australian farmers now for 25 years, and he believes that an understanding of subtle energy will be the next big area of potential change in agriculture.
That is really saying something, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course it's a big call for an organisation like RCS to go out on a limb like that, and it's not the first time they've done it. I mean, even when they introduced time control or cell grazing way back 22 years ago. It was out there on a limb a bit, but this one's probably even more out on a limb. So, but we've all seen, all of us who've had some experience with it, have seen so much change in people and other aspects of a farm that we know that it's so important.
So, Gary, how do people start? Is there a particular place they get in touch with? Do they get in touch with RCS, or do they get in touch with who do they get in touch with?
So there's a Dawson program website. This is on the human health side. RCS can certainly, because a lot of RCS clients have done some basic training in this work. RCS can steer people in the right direction. The Dawson program website, which outlines any training that's coming up. Linda, my wife, and I are running a training program in Bingara, which will be two modules, but it starts at the end of this month. So that's in the Dawson program side. In the geomancy side, there are a number of people, but RCS, as I said before, is bringing Patrick McManaway out three times a year now. So he's here and he's running courses, and he coincidentally will also be running one in our local town, Bingara, in July. And all of that's on the RCS website.
So in terms of increasing profitability on a farm, if a farmer's open-minded, we say all farmers are, which they're not, but we'll say they all are, and they come along and did that course, would they, do you think somewhere along the line, sometime in the future, they could improve profitability on their farms by using changing their own energy or...
I can safely say that they will become much more open to ideas. One of the real challenges we face in farming and in rural communities generally, and I'm very involved in and very concerned about rural communities, and a lot of my effort and energy goes into that area locally. One of the dangers, particularly when things get a bit tough, and there is no doubt that for a significant proportion of farmers things are tough at the moment. When things become tough, it's very easy to withdraw and become very insular. And I see that in farming families, and I see it in rural communities. I see a lot of rural communities, particularly smaller rural communities, who just don't want to know. They've just put up the shutters and said it's all too hard out there, and we're not really all that interested in exploring how we might do things differently. And that's a recipe for death, really.
Just to butt in on that and sort of elaborate on that point a little bit, last week's The Land newspaper said that in Western Australia, in a place called Tindara, that 1,001 farmers got there, and they were farmers who couldn't get money to put their crop in. And that broadacre farmers. So those farmers would be quite desperate, really, and I think that'd fall in the categories what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we should understate the challenge that farmers are currently facing, and there's a real problem financially for a lot of farmers, and I don't think it's recognised. And when that happens, there's a real problem financially for rural communities. If you take a town like Bingara, which is our local community, it's a population of 1,300 people. It's about 80% dependent on the rural economy. And when you're a community of 1,300 people, you are a community on the knife edge. Like, we have a very prosperous, vital, active community, but you take 100 people out of that community and all of a sudden, you no longer have one of everything in terms of support, shops and facilities and so on. And so many rural communities right throughout Australia are at that point or have tipped over the edge. And it's very hard once you tip over the edge to claw it back. It's a real area of concern and essentially unrecognised by our political parties, both state and federal.
Yeah, you made a mention of that in the bigger talk, and I won't bring in my opinion in that case, because I think, I'll say something, that I think this federal government buying water for environmental reasons. I think that's a hoax, actually. I think that it's taking water out of the farming communities and putting it into the hands of government. That's just a personal opinion.
I really haven't studied that sort of water buyback, but it seems to me that it was very poorly thought through.
Exactly.
And I think the outcomes are just a lot of money that's been essentially wasted.
Taxpayers'
There's
money.
There's been a lot of that, unfortunately, over the last little while.
Yeah. So we were talking about synergy. So if a farmer's in desperate, he looks up the website of the Dawson website, and he gets enough interest to attend the courses. So then he becomes more open-minded, and from there things could change.
Yeah, look, I mean, energy balancing is just one of the tools that everybody has available to them. It's an important one, I believe, and one that's been largely unrecognised. But it's just one of a suite of things that we need to do, obviously. Our diet and is important on human health. Our relationships are important. And then there's a range of other courses, and RCS does this very, very well. Their flagship course, the GSP School, has just transformed the lives of many of the 5,500 farmers that have done that over a period of 20 years.
So what is that course again? Can you say it again?
The course is a grazing for profit school.
Oh, yes, of course.
7-day school. It's a flagship school of RCS. And it's a wonderful piece of education. My wife and I have done, I think, just about every course that's ever offered by anybody, and this one stands out as just being a very, very clever piece of education. It really engages people, and the rate of change for people who do it is amazing.
And would that cover some of the work like the pasture cropping or this type of farming or native grasses?
It does a lot of that. It really challenges people all the way through, and it's all about people learning to think for themselves. I describe it as a sort of a business school for farmers because it covers all sorts of things. It's called Grazing for Profit, and people think it's all about grazing management. I think there's a half day on grazing management, and the rest is really all about the multitude of things that go into successfully running a farm, including a lot of personal development work. That's one of the things that we as farmers, for some peculiar reason, like people who are employed in every other company in Australia, spend a lot of time on personal development. It's fundamental to training, and yet in farming we don't think it's important, have never really been exposed to it. And yet it's so critical in terms of the way in which we think and behave and react and anticipate and so on.
Well, Helen, myself have done a fair bit of personal development courses, and when we talk to friends about it, they can't hear us. So how could you make a farmer to hear that what the personal development has got something to do with driving machinery or putting a crop in or whatever?
Yeah, it's not easy. I guess word of mouth has been the basis of marketing courses like that. People who've done it will say, wow, that was just the most amazing experience, and talk to their fellow farmers. The challenge, I think, in education in farming communities is what we call the low-hanging fruit, the people who are most open to change, have mostly done this sort of training over the last 20 years. But they still only represent maybe 5% of the farming community. And as we get into the other 95%, it becomes much harder to persuade people that there's real value in doing this sort of training.
Well, I've never heard anyone who's done the RCS courses not to be really pleased that they've done them.
Yeah, I agree. I've done the same. Yeah. And it is amazing. I did that GFP school back in 1992, and it was fundamental to us changing the way we ran our business. And I didn't do it again. I didn't go and repeat it, and that's an invitation that people have, until I was invited to consider teaching it, which is about 6 years ago now, 7 years. And I then, with Terry McCosker, did a school up at Townsville, And I sat down the back to get a sense of how the course actually hung together and took notes. And I ended up with 12 pages of ideas for our business. And we thought we'd been implementing everything that there was in a CSP school for the preceding 10 years or so. So yeah, there's a huge amount in that course, and it's just incredibly valuable.
Well, saying you've got half a page, you've done well. If you've got 12 pages, that's quite a bit to select from.
A lot to select from, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And as
so
you said,
doing it the second time was actually probably as valuable as doing it the first.
Yes.
And
as you said,
I've probably done it or taught it maybe another, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 times. And each time there's a lot to learn.
Yeah, yeah. And you're interacting with farmers too.
Yeah, and it's the same. Every time you interact with other farmers, you learn, and that's as much you learn as much there as you do from the material of any of those courses.
Yeah. Now, Gary, we have got farmers on the line, and I quite often our farmers don't. They just, you know, stay online, and they don't want to say anything. And
come on in, farmers.
I will invite any farmer who is online to just start talking. Don't wait for us to sort of say who you are. Yeah, we just want you to just ask a question, if anything that's of concern, and hopefully you have listened to Gary's Walk the Talk with Gary McDougall, and there's something there of that you want answered, or you just want to have make your comment on it. So please just say what you want to say. So don't wait for a gap.
There's a gap, jump in.
Now, Gary, we will just keep... you mentioned a few things that... you mentioned, for instance, the rainforests on the most productive is the most productive well the most such a mass of vegetation on the poorest soils in the world. How would that statement relate to farming, or the way you're farming, or can you sort of relate that to, in other words, how do you get to that stage of high productivity through vegetation?
So I think the point about the rainforests is that they are the most, in terms of biomass production, they're the most productive areas in the world. And they may or may not have a very high rainfall. Actually, there are rainforests in quite low areas of rainfall with equally high levels of production. And the interesting question is why? What is it about a rainforest that makes it so productive? And the answer lies in the synergy between all of the things that grow there. So a rainforest evolves so that all sorts of areas of production are complementary to and synergistic with other areas of production. That's what drives it. So if you take that model and you compare it with the model that we've developed in agriculture, which is largely very low biodiversity, monoculture production. And in fact, there's been confusing messages, because if you analyse the profitability of farming ventures over the last 20 years, those who've adopted that specialised approach have by and large been more profitable, or certainly had higher levels of production. And as I said before, they're not necessarily the same thing, but they've been regarded as more profitable than people who've had multi-ventures. And so we need to say, okay, well, if you look at the rainforest analogy, can we change what we do? Can we engage in a multiplicity of ventures that are not just lots of separate ventures, which, and if that's the approach you adopt, then you're just going to become too busy and not do anything particularly well. But can we design ventures that are synergistic with each other? And I guess the sort of model that Giles Salatin, who's been a frequent visitor to our shores, practices in the States and preaches when he comes out here, is the sort of model that I think of the ideas that are that where the seeds for the future of agriculture probably exist. And that is, what can we do where the sum is not 2 + 2 = 4, the sum is 2 + 2 = 7? How can we actually generate more productivity out of a particular area of country? And whenever people say, oh, you can't do it in this rainfall, you can't do it in this soil type, or you can't do it wherever, there's a permaculture video that you may well have seen, and I recommend everybody Google it and have a look at it, called Greening the Desert. And it's the story of a permaculture garden developed in Jordan, I think it is, in an area that has 5-inch annual rainfall. The soil is essentially sand. It's below sea level. It's pretty grim. It's about as grim an area of agriculture as you could ever anticipate operating in. And yet the level of production that's been generated in this garden is outstanding, and it's because they've planted things that are synergistic with other things. And if we say, well, the average rainfall in Australia is very many times 5 inches, then we've got huge potential, really.
Gary, when we're talking to quite a few of our farmers over in the West, they've got multiples of thousands of acres. They've got two sets of machinery. And do you think that they could go to the RCS course on sort of merging a few things together and come up with some sort of diversity on their property? Because, you know, they are... it's all about filling up their machines and going out in the paddock again.
Look, it's a totally different model, and there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of experimental work, and I think there are a few keys to that. Firstly, we need to pull somehow or other all of these people who are choosing to do things differently together, and what we're doing in Bingra with the Living Classroom, I think, is one point where we can start to focus on doing those sorts of things.
So will you explain that? Will you explain that when it's appropriate to explain that?
Yeah, so the Living Classroom is really a project that came out, the first thing it came out of was creating a vision for our local town and district, which is another really important part of the key to success, I believe, and I've seen the power of it in business and in farming families. I've seen the power of it with individuals, and I've now seen the power of it in the community. Back in 2005, we did 12 months worth of community consultation and wrote a vision for the future of our town and district. And it is just amazing the number of ticks we've got against that vision and the subsequent strategic plan that we put in place. So what we said out of all of that is that, look, essentially we're a farming community, and farming is always going to be an important part of what we do. We asked ourselves the question, what else can we do? And we identified three other major streams of industry or income. One was tourism, and lots of rural communities focus on that. One was regional conferencing, and we happen to be quite well positioned to do that. And the fourth was education, and we actually have one of the lower levels of education of any rural community in New South Wales. So our challenge was to substantially lift that. So then we said, well, what sort of project or projects can we identify that's going to have components of each of those four industries and where each of those is synergistic with the other? And we came up with the Living Classroom, and the Living Classroom is to take an area of approximately 200 hectares of common, and I'm not sure whether commons exist in every state in Australia, but they're widespread in New South Wales, and they are generally areas on the fringe of towns that have been not managed or mismanaged seriously for probably 100 years in many cases. They were valid things when people had a draft horse or a milking cow or whatever, but they no longer are. But they're very strategically located. And in this case, the resource base of that common had been run down because it's just been mismanaged. And we said, well, what can we do with that? And so the Living Classroom is all about creating a model for the future of agriculture. So it's got a research component, it's got a significant education component, it's got a major tourism component, it will be a centre for regional conferencing. So it encompasses all of those four areas that we've been talking about. And it's a significant project now. We've spent one way or another, and this is money that's come into the community that would not otherwise. I think it's about $1.5 million has gone into that project so far. And it's just at a really exciting stage where we're moving beyond infrastructure and into the living part of it, the planting part of it, the synergistic operation between various ventures. So, and I think it's just one of a number of these sorts of things that will evolve and are evolving around the world that will showcase effectively and demonstrate how we can do things differently in agriculture.
So the living classroom would suit agriculture's, would suit agriculture as well?
That's absolutely the intent of it, yeah. So, as I said, it's an area of 200 hectares. It's big enough to do all sorts of integrated trials. So we're not interested in the traditional scientific trial plot where you isolate all the variables and plant 20 different varieties of the same species and then try and evaluate the outcome. This is about a much more holistic approach, a total farm management approach, but engaging and trialing and experimenting with a whole range of different opportunities. And then extending those on farms. So we're in the process of building a network of cooperator farms. So these are people who are working closely with the project and will extend some of the ideas there that are valid for their enterprise onto a more broad acre scale. And we're also in the process of developing what I call an experiential network. So all of those sorts of interested out there farmers who are doing things differently, we see them becoming, if you like, friends of this project and very closely related with it. So a two-way flow of information between the project and what they're doing on their farms.
Sounds extremely exciting. Gary, I had to block off farmers because it's getting a noise, so I am going to open up the lines again.
Right.
I will open up the line again, but then if I do close them, if a farmer will just press *7 and start talking. That's all you have to do is press *7 and start talking. That'll open up the line irrespective of if I've got you blocked off or not. We'll just open them up at the moment. And,
hello, Hugo.
Yeah. Who've got on the line?
Yeah, got Roy McLean here.
Oh, yes, Roy.
Yeah. Hello, Gary.
Yeah, g'day, Roy, is it?
Yeah, Roy.
Yeah, how are you,
Roy? Gary, you mentioned earlier there you run some courses. I just can't remember what names of them were now. Whereabouts do you hold them? Do you hold them mainly in the northern area of Australia, or do you hold any down the south, southern areas of Australia?
Well, RCS itself runs courses all around Australia, but particularly at the moment in New South Wales and Queensland and up into the Territory and some in Western Australia. But given the right sort of interest and numbers, we'll run them anywhere, really.
Right.
And then the Dawson, the energy work that I'm talking about, again, is around Australia. We tend to, Linda and I, as practitioners and teachers, tend to focus in this part of the world, but the same information is taught. There's a course around about the same time as we're running one here at the end of this month in Victoria, for example.
Ah, right. Do you know whereabouts, Gary?
Yeah, look, I do know.
It would be on the website, Dawson website.
It'll be on the Dawson program website. And it's
Oh, it sounds quite interesting, Gary.
It's fascinating stuff. Mm. Absolutely fascinating, and can have a huge impact on people, certainly.
No, I'll be interested in following that up.
We've only got an opportunity, I think it's in about 3 weeks' time. So.
Yeah. All right.
Slip into it quickly, there's a course, but there'll be more courses of it.
Right. That's in Victoria you're talking about?
Yes, that's in Victoria. Whereabouts are you?
I'm in the bottom of South Australia.
Yeah, right.
In Mount Gambier.
Yes, Yep. So there's a few people over that way that I know of that have done this sort of training. Do you know Nick Kettish at all?
Yeah, I do. He's not down here anymore, but
not
he was
now.
Here.
I know that he's moved, but they've certainly done some of this sort of training, so if you wanted to have a chat to him. No. And there are quite a few others from down that way.
Ah, right, right.
They've done the work as well.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm not aware of anybody running courses in South Australia at the moment.
Gary, do you have to have any size farm to benefit from this sort of course?
So the energy work is really applicable to anybody, whether they're a farmer or not.
Okay.
And a lot of people have done that training and not farmers, but the majority are. And for some strange reason, some sort of connection with the land seems to be, people come to it a lot easier than they do if they don't. I mean, they don't have that sort of earthbound connection, I suppose.
I'll just bring something into this conversation which you've sort of touched on, Gary, but when I'm reading Dr. Manaway's, Patrick Manaway's flyer, that he says that, on the flyer, it says that you can change your energies on the farm, influence energies on the farm, which sounds absolutely extraordinary. That when you change energies on the farm, that can lead to more extra profitability. So can you sort of put a bit more light into what I was trying to say?
yeah, look, it's there's lots of different energetic impact that can affect the farm production or profitability. So the first is related to energy lines or fields or whatever, and as I said, the earth is crisscrossed with those, and working with those energy fields can certainly lead to increases in productivity. There's also ways of increasing the overall energy levels on the farm, and there's lots of work that's been done on this. And partly that's dictated by the approach or the attitude of the owners of the farm. So it's not absolutely, it follows, obviously, if somebody is passionate and feels very positive about their farm, then they're likely to be a better producer. And that just is what you'd logically and sensibly think. But there's more to it than that, because your attitude and intention to your piece of dirt actually does have an impact on the energy fields that exist within it. It's sort of a bit hard to get your head around, but it does, and that in turn will translate to every living thing on that farm. And that's the sort of stuff that Patrick does and can demonstrate it in a whole variety of ways. And it's really quite powerful stuff. But in its relative infancy in terms of being taught in the West, although well understood in many other societies in the world.
That is absolutely extraordinary, and I would just invite anyone to look into it. Certainly Hal and myself will be looking into it.
Yeah.
Not
I think one of the important things is that it's another tool. And one of the things when people stumble across a tool like that is that you can get very carried away with it to the detriment of the other tools that we've got. So it's only a tool. It's one of a range of tools. It's an important one. But we need to address all of those things that we've got to work with as well.
Yeah. Now, just going forward a little bit, you mentioned in your talk regenerative farming is, we must follow nature. So obviously regenerative farming is the way to go. So can you give a bit of an explanation on that statement, or correct the statement I just made?
Well, I think the seeds of that lie in the sort of statements we talked about earlier, which is that essentially in farming we've been running down or mining our resource base over a long period of time, and that's quite demonstrable. Well, I did say there are exceptions to that, but the majority of farming country has been run down, and our focus has been on the financial side of the exercise, on our financial balance sheet and profit and loss and so on, and we really haven't run an ecological balance sheet, and we haven't ensured that we've built that as well as attempted to build our financial balance sheet. And I think we've now reached the point in time where we have to have them both running in tandem. And in fact, if you look to the longer term, that's the only way in which we can be a sustainable industry, is that if we stabilise and then rebuild our resource base. So the term regenerative farming, I believe, is related to rebuilding the resource base. And I think there are ways of doing that where not only do you rebuild your resource base, but you underwrite your financial side of your balance sheet whilst you do it. And that's the key. That's what regenerative farming is all about. And I don't think there's, I mean, we tend in farming to get very carried away with systems, you know, this system's better than that system, etc. It's really about understanding the principles. What is it that we need to do to regenerate agriculture? And I think the fundamental to that is that we need to, and we would have heard this from lots of sources now, to be working with nature rather than working against nature. And if you look at what we've done for the last 50 years, since the Second World War, most of what we've done has been focused on combating nature. And we've got to switch that. And we've got to switch it at all levels, on farm, in terms of agronomy, in terms of scientific approach. And the reach, and the thing that I think we can reach agreement on relatively easily is the principles that we need to adopt and then test what we do against those principles. But we will never reach agreement if we argue about one system being better or worse than another system. It's about getting some understanding on the principles.
When you talk about rebuilding resources, the one thing it's bandied around by some farm or some experts is putting carbon into the soil. What are the sort of resources that you're talking about, or what do you mean by the ecological way of farming?
Well, our fundamental resource is the soil. And we've already talked about the fact that, the peak indicator of soil health is the level of carbon in it. So if you're actually sequestering carbon and rebuilding the carbon levels in the soil, then almost by definition you're rebuilding the soil health and soil quality. And that's where we've got to be, that's what we've got to be shooting for. So then it's a question of what techniques are there, what things can we do to actually build that soil. And I always like the garden analogy. You know, virtually everybody in the country's dabble with growing vegetables or played around in the garden. And the approach that's adopted by and large in people, with people who do that, and certainly people who've got green fingers and so on, is all about soil development. That's what it's about. And yet, for some strange reason, when we get to the farm gate, we adopt a different approach. And we can no longer afford to do that. So we need to work with all of the tools that we've got at our disposal to rebuild soil health. And there's a multiplicity of them. Just a question of applying them.
Yeah, but when you talk about a garden and then you talk about thousands of acres, are you implying that some of the systems of gardening can apply to thousands of acres?
Absolutely. Yeah, I do, and one of the we've always seen that the answers to success or viability in farming lies in more acres, and scale has been a major driver over the last 20 years. In the last 10 years, for example, and these figures will be far worse now than they were at the time that they were first quoted, but the size of cattle enterprise, say, in central Queensland, that's needed to support a nuclear family, husband and wife and a couple of kids, has gone up three times in 10 years. And if you look at the current level of profitability with current cattle prices, it's going to be even worse than that. Now, the impact of that, as you increase that scale, is less farming families, is more overseas ownership or corporate ownership, is less viable rural communities. It's a spiral recipe for disaster on everything except a view, perhaps, which is held, and I know is held at federal government level, that that's the answer. We've just got to get bigger. You know, we're all familiar with to get bigger or get out thing. So, and then the question is, are those enterprises at that scale really focused on rebuilding the resource base? And the answer by and large is no. And so what can we do with existing areas of land to be much more profitable on them? And that's the challenge. And I think that's what we're trying to work with in the living classroom. And I think that's where the answers lie. Certainly for more intensive farming areas like the area we live in, and certainly for smaller rural communities. We need more people in those communities, not less.
I'm really glad that you just brought that conversation back to the living classroom, where it's something that's it's being practical. Is it working?
It's relatively early days, so
it's promising, obviously.
Oh, hugely promising and terribly exciting for lots of people who are now starting to become engaged with the project. It's interesting, and it's typical, that when this project was first floated within our community, it was treated with enormous scepticism. And within the community, but for people external to the community who saw it and understood the sort of potential of it, it was very, very exciting. And we're gradually changing that as people see things happening and they appreciate the income earning potential and appreciate the employment opportunities and that sort of thing. It's changing. But that attitude of our rural community is very typical of the attitude of rural communities right throughout Australia and of farmers, unfortunately. And it just is very hard to think outside the box.
With that living classroom, is that going to be something that other farmers from other areas could learn from, or is it a closed shop for Bingara area?
Oh, no, absolutely not. No, we see that the first step is regional. So our regional development board here in the north and northwest, we've got an application in at the moment for some regional partnership funding to build an interpretive centre on this site. And for 2 years in succession, we've been shortlisted by that regional development board because they believe this project ticks every box for regional development. And so that's regional, but what we're doing, we believe, is of national and international significance. And there is absolutely no reason, particularly given the communication that we now have, why we can't forge very, very strong links right across Australia and around the world.
That sounds awfully exciting. Well, it is awfully exciting. As you said, it's a new project and looks like it is developing. But I picked up a key thing, which you said that the community, a fair bit of the community, was sceptical, and it was outside some outsiders that could see the value in it. Can you sort of explain that a little bit or elaborate a little bit on that? Because why I'm asking you that question is that it's going to have the same scepticism in other rural areas where they sort of think, we can't do that, we haven't got whatever reasons why we can't do it.
Yeah, there's always a good reason why you can't do things, isn't there? And that tends to be, we just seem to be genetically engineered as a human race to think that way. What we've really got to do is change that psychology so that we ask ourselves, well, why can't we do it? And what can we do that's different? But it really comes back to that insularity that I referred to earlier as a fundamental problem in farming communities in particular, amongst farmers and in farming communities, that it's very easy to put up the shutters and say, it's all too hard, I don't want to know, and we'll just continue to do things the way that we always have. And the upshot of that is far too evident all around Australia in dying rural communities. And there's nothing sadder than a dying country town, and unfortunately, as you drive around, you see them all over the place.
You do. Now, look, I think that, I just do know what you're going to do there is just absolutely extraordinary, and it's fantastic, because it can start reversing the thing, start reversing what the situation is in rural areas. So, I just hope it catches on more. I know it'll catch on, but I just hope it catches on quickly, and hope farmers can get past that thing where they where they are desperate. I just do know the well, our farmers have explained to us that they're desperate and they can't afford something which is, you know, really something which should have sort of money that you should have floating in your wallet. And they can't afford that. So, yeah, it's a very exciting what you're doing, and hopefully it does catch on. Well, it will catch on, but hopefully it catches on with a lot more speed.
Yep. No, look, I'm confident that it is, and it will. And I also am confident that this sort of thing is happening in pockets. And I know that it's happening in pockets all around the world. And what we just need to do is to link these pockets of activity so that what's seen to be happening is a mainstream movement rather than a sort of fringe movement. You know, if you look at where most of the money in agriculture is going, and agriculture research and education, and both of those areas have been in decline now for probably the last 10 years, and the money that is spent very much on behalf of vested interests, and that's another whole topic. But that's happening at the very time, in my view, that we should be actually ramping up our investment in agricultural education and research, and I think we'll rue the day that we haven't. And we'll wake up in about 5 or 6 years' time and say, wow, we're in danger of missing all sorts of opportunities. And there'll be this sort of amazing catch-up period. So we're running against the trend, really. We're trying to develop an agricultural research station when research stations are being shut all around the country. We're ramping up our exposure to agricultural education at a time when agricultural education is really struggling in most areas of Australia. I think we'll hopefully have some real momentum at about the time that we all wake up and say how critical it is that we should be doing it.
Is any of RCS's influence, well, it must be because I imagine you're well involved, so is any of RCS's type of influence is involved in this living classroom?
Yeah, RCS is very supportive of the project. They're actually, we'll be running two courses there over the next month or two. It's absolutely attuned or aligned with RCS's philosophy.
So there is classroom facilities at this living classroom thing.
Sorry, what's that?
There is a classroom
So far what we've got is we've got the area of land, it's all the titles tidied up. We've spent about $140,000 in providing water security on the site, so there's two very attractively designed lakes, we call them, rather than dams. We've solved a flooding problem in the town by bringing water across to those storages, and all of the water movement is basically with swales, so the idea is to keep as much water as possible on the site rather than run it off, which is the way in which things have been managed in the past. We have a set of classrooms, which is a trade training centre for agriculture, which is a nice building. We've got some accommodation, bunkhouse accommodation for 24 students and a couple of teachers. And we've got the infrastructure in terms of roadways and pathways and that sort of thing. And we're just at the most exciting stage, which is where we start to design the agriculture ventures and start the living part, the planting part. So that's about to happen. We've completed a business plan which shows some really exciting projections, and it's been adopted. There's been a lot of rigour going into that. It's all happening.
It's very, very exciting, and I hope that farmers have heard what you've had to say and show interest in what you've got to say, because rural towns, when they start disappearing, it becomes quite hard for the rural community, whether it's a service they have to sort of travel extra, you know, huge distance for a particular service, and the problem just goes on.
Well, this is a town, as I said, it's only 1,300 people, but you can't get a park in the main street, or you struggle to get a park in the main street on most days. It's got people comment when they come into it that it's got a real buzz about it. It's only got a buzz about it because a whole range of people have been doing this thinking outside the box now for probably at least the last 10 years or so. We've got lots of other things going on in the town. But even so, we're going to have to keep working at it. 1,300 people is, as I said before, it's a knife edge.
Yep.
And we can't afford to let that population drop.
Gary, we could talk for another half hour, but
we could.
Thank you very much. So I want to close this off now, and I just thank all the farmers who have been on the line and the questions. There was a couple of questions I didn't ask on behalf of farmers, which was about, how to work with hard soil but we'll cover that another time. Gary, I'd just like to thank you very, very much for coming online, and is there a particular thing that you'd like to say as a closing off statement?
No, only that if people want to explore some of the opportunities, most of the information, in the case of RCS, is on their website. In the case of the Dawson program, is on their website. And in the case of a living classroom, if you just Google the living classroom Bingra, there's now a fledgling website, but it's actually got quite a lot of information on it, which will give people an insight as to what we're on about.
Well, that's fantastic. That's a wonderful summary. All right.
Thank you, Hugo.
Thank you very, very much, Gary. Thank you for spending your time. I know your time is very valuable. And so I'd like to thank you very, very much for coming online. And this will be available as a CD to our farmers. And so I just want to thank you once again, Gary.
My pleasure, Hugo.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.